wouldn't be coming back to the house in the hills, that she was going to spend the night in their Shinano Machi condo. Professor Ebisuno's daughter was also supposed to spend the night there, but Fukaeri never showed up. They haven't heard from her since. Tengo traced his memory back 3 days, but could think of nothing relevant. They have absolutely no idea where she is. I thought she might have contacted you. I haven't heard a thing, Tengo said. More than 4 weeks must have gone by since she spent the night in his apartment. Tengo momentarily wondered whether he ought to tell Komatsu what she had said back then, that she had better not go back to the Shinano Machi condo. She might have been sensing something ominous about the place. But he decided not to mention it. He didn't want to have to tell Komatsu that Fukaeri had stayed at his apartment. "She's an odd girl," Tengo said. "She might have just gone off somewhere by herself without telling anybody." "No, I don't think so. She may not look it, but Fukaeri is a very conscientious person. She's always very clear about her whereabouts, always phoning to say where she is or where she's going and when. That's what Professor Ebisuno tells me. For her to be out of touch for 3 full days is not at all usual for her. Something bad might have happened." "Something bad," Tengo growled. "The professor and his daughter are both very worried," Komatsu said. "In any case, if she stays missing like this, it'll put you in a difficult position, I'm sure," Tengo said to Komatsu. "True, especially if the police get involved. I mean, think about it. Beautiful teenage writer of runaway bestseller disappears. You know the media would go crazy over that one. Then they're going to drag me out for comments as her editor. No good can come of that. I'm strictly a shadow figure. I don't do well in the sunlight. Once something like that gets going, the truth could come out at any point." "What does Professor Ebisuno say?" "That he's going to file a search request with the police, maybe as soon as tomorrow," Komatsu said. "I got him to hold off for a few days, but it's not something that can be postponed for very long. If the media get wind of the search request, they'll be all over this. I don't know how the police are going to respond, but Fukaeri is the girl of the moment, not just some teenage runaway. Keeping this out of the public eye will likely be impossible." That might have been exactly what Professor Ebisuno was hoping for, Tengo thought. To cause a sensation using Fukaeri as bait, exploit it to clarify the relationship of Sakigake to Fukaeri's parents, and learn the couple's whereabouts. If so, then the professor's plan was working as he had imagined it would. But had the professor fully grasped how dangerous this might prove to be? He certainly should have. Professor Ebisuno was not a thoughtless person. Indeed, deep thinking was exactly what he did for a living. And besides, there seemed to be a number of important facts surrounding Fukaeri's situation of which Tengo was unaware, as though he were trying to assemble a jigsaw puzzle without having been given all the pieces. A wise person would have avoided getting involved from the beginning. "Do you have any idea where she might be, Tengo?" Komatsu asked.
"Not at the moment."
"No," Komatsu said, with a perceptible note of fatigue in his voice. He was not a man who often let such human failings show. "Sorry I woke you in the middle of the night." To hear words of apology coming from Komatsu's mouth was also a rare occurrence. "That's okay," Tengo said, "given the situation." "You know, Tengo, if I had my way, I would have preferred not to involve you in these real-world complications. Your only job was to do the writing, and you carried that off splendidly. But things never work out as smoothly as we want them to. And as I said to you once before, we're all shooting the rapids in the same boat." Tengo mechanically finished the sentence.
"Exactly.
But come to think of it," Tengo added, "won't Air Chrysalis just sell all the more if Fukaeri's disappearance becomes news?"
"It's selling enough already," Komatsu said with a note of resignation. "We don't need any more publicity. The only thing a scandal will net us is trouble. What we ought to be thinking about is a nice, quiet spot to land in."
"A spot to land in," Tengo said. Komatsu made a sound as though he were swallowing some imaginary thing. Then he lightly cleared his throat.
"Well, let's have a nice long talk about that over dinner sometime, after this mess gets cleaned up. Good night, Tengo. You ought to get a good night's rest."
Komatsu hung up. As if he had just had a curse laid on him, Tengo could no longer sleep. He felt tired, but he couldn't get to sleep.
What was this, you ought to get a good night's rest business? He thought about doing some work at the kitchen table, but he wasn't in the mood. He took a bottle of whiskey from the cabinet, poured some into a glass, and drank it straight in small sips. Maybe Fukaeri had been kidnapped by Sakigake. It seemed entirely plausible to Tengo. A bunch of them had staked out her Shinanumachi condo, forced her into a car, and taken her away. It was by no means impossible if they had chosen the right moment and acted quickly. Maybe Fukaeri had already sensed their presence when she said she had better not go back to the condo. Both the little people and air chrysalises actually existed, Fukaeri had told Tengo. She had met the little people in the Sakigake commune when she was being punished for having carelessly let the blind goat die, and she had made an air chrysalis with them for several nights running. As a result, something of great significance had happened to her. She had put the events into a story, and Tengo had refashioned the story into a finished piece of fiction. In other words, he had transformed it into a commodity, and that commodity was, to borrow Komatsu's expression, selling like hotcakes. This in turn might be distressing to Sakigake. The stories of the little people and the air chrysalis might be major secrets that must not be divulged to the outside world. And so, to prevent any further leaks, they had kidnapped Fukaeri and shut her up. They had resorted to force, even if it meant risking the possibility that her disappearance might arouse public suspicion. This was, of course, nothing more than Tengo's hypothesis. He had no evidence he could offer, no way he could prove it. Even if he told people the little people and air chrysalises actually exist, who could possibly take him seriously? First of all, Tengo himself did not know what it meant to say that such things actually exist. Another possibility was that Fukaeri had become sick of all the hype surrounding her bestseller and had gone into hiding. This was entirely conceivable, of course. It was all but impossible to predict what she would do, but assuming she went into hiding, she would probably have left some kind of message for Professor Ebisuno and his daughter Azami. There would have been no reason for her to worry them. It was easy for Tengo to imagine, however, that Fukaeri might be in great danger if she had actually been abducted by Sakigake. Just as there had been no word from her parents, all word of Fukaeri might be lost. Even if the relationship between Fukaeri and Sakigake were revealed, which would not take a very long time, and this gave rise to a media scandal, it would all be for nothing if the police refused to get involved on the grounds that there was no physical evidence that she was abducted. She might remain locked up somewhere inside the high-walled religious commune. Had Professor Ebisuno concocted a plan that included such a worst-case scenario? Tengo wanted to call Professor Ebisuno and ask him all these questions, but it was already past midnight, and he could only wait until tomorrow. The next morning, Tengo dialed the number he was given to call Professor Ebisuno's house, but the call did not go through. All he got was the recorded message, "The number you have dialed is not presently in service. Please check the number and dial again." He tried again several times, but always with the same results. He guessed that they had changed phone numbers after Fukaeri's debut, due to an onslaught of calls requesting interviews. Nothing unusual happened during the following week. Air Chrysalis went on selling in the same high numbers, coming out again at the top of the national bestseller list. No one contacted Tengo during the week. He tried phoning Komatsu at his office a few times, but he was always out, which was not unusual. Tengo left a message with the editorial office for Komatsu to call, but no call came, which was also not unusual. He read the newspaper every day, but found no report that a search request had been filed for Fukaeri. Could Professor Ebisuno have decided not to file one? Perhaps he had filed a request, but the police had not publicized it so as to search for her in secret, or they had not taken it seriously, treating it as just another case of a runaway teenager. As always, Tengo taught mathematics at the cram school 3 days a week, continued writing his novel on other days, and spent Friday afternoon having intense sex with his girlfriend when she visited his apartment. But he could not focus. He spent day after day feeling uneasy and muddled, like someone who had mistakenly swallowed a thick swatch of cloud. He began losing his appetite. He would wake up at odd times in the middle of the night, unable to get back to sleep. Then he would think about Fukairi. Where was she now? What was she doing? Whom was she with? What was happening to her? He imagined a variety of situations, all of them with minor variations, deeply pessimistic. In the scenes he imagined, she was always wearing her thin, tight-fitting sweater that showed off the lovely shape of her breasts. The image made him gasp for breath and only added to his agitation. It was on the Thursday of the sixth week after Air Chrysalis became a permanent fixture on the bestseller list that Fukairi finally got in touch with him.
Chapter 23 Aomame. This is just the beginning of something. Aomame and Ayumi were the perfect pair to host intimate but fully erotic all-night sex feasts. Ayumi was petite and cheerful, comfortable with strangers and talkative. She brought a positive attitude to just about any situation once she had made up her mind to do so. She also had a healthy sense of humor. By contrast, Aomame, slim and muscular, tended to be rather expressionless and reserved, and she found it hard to be witty with the man she was meeting for the first time. In her speech, there was a subtle note of cynicism and even hostility, and in her eyes, an equally subtle gleam of intolerance. Still, when she felt like it, Aomame gave off a cool aura that naturally attracted men. It was like the sweet, sexually stimulating fragrance that animals or insects give off when necessary. This was not something that could be learned through conscious effort. It was probably inborn. But no, she might well have acquired the fragrance for some reason at a certain stage of life. In any case, this aura subtly aroused not only her sexual partners, but also Ayumi, adding color and a positive warmth to their evenings. Whenever they encountered suitable men, first Ayumi approached them with her natural cheer. Then Aomame would join them at an appropriate moment, creating a unique atmosphere that was part operetta, part film noir. Once things got to that point, the rest was simple. They would move to an appropriate place and, as Ayumi bluntly put it, fuck like mad. The hardest thing was finding suitable partners. Preferably, they should be two men together, clean and reasonably good-looking. They had to be at least somewhat intellectual, but too much so could be a problem. Boring conversation could turn the evening sterile. They also had to look like men who had money to spend. Obviously, the men paid for the drinks and the hotel rooms. When they tried to hold a nice little sex feast near the end of June, however, in what would turn out to be their last team activity, they simply could not find suitable men. They put a lot of time into it, changing venues several times, always with the same results. In spite of the fact that it was the last Friday of the month, all the clubs they tried, from Roppongi to Akasaka, were shockingly quiet, almost deserted, giving them no real choice. Maybe it had something to do with the heavy clouds that hung in the sky, as if the whole of Tokyo were in mourning for someone. "It doesn't look good today," Aomame said. "Maybe we should give up." It was already 10:30. Ayumi reluctantly agreed. "I've never seen such a dead Friday night. And here I'm wearing my sexy purple underwear. So go home and get carried away with yourself in the mirror. Not even I have the guts to do that in the police dorm bathroom. Anyhow, let's just forget it. We'll have a nice, quiet drink, then head home and go to bed." "That may be the best thing," Ayumi said. Then, as if she had suddenly recalled something, she added, "Say, let's have a bite to eat before we go home. I've got an extra 30,000 yen in my purse." Aomame frowned. "Extra? How come? You're always complaining how little they pay you." Ayumi scratched the side of her nose. "Actually, the last time. The guy gave me 30,000 yen. He called it taxi fare and handed it to me when we said goodbye. You know, the time we did it with those real estate guys. And you just took it? Aomame asked, shocked. Maybe he thought we were semi-pros, Ayumi said with a chuckle. I bet it never crossed his mind he was dealing with a cop and a martial arts instructor. Anyhow, what's the difference? I'm sure he makes tons of money in real estate, more than he knows what to do with. I kept it separate, figured I'd spend it with you on a nice meal or something. I mean, money like that you don't want to use on just regular expenses. Aomame did not tell Ayumi how she felt about this. To have taken money for casual sex with the man she didn't know. She could hardly comprehend the fact that such a thing had occurred. She felt as if she were looking at a twisted image of herself in a warped mirror. Ethically, which was better, taking money for killing men or taking money for having sex with men?
Tell me, Ayumi asked Aomame uneasily, does the idea of taking money from a man bother you?
Aomame shook her head. It doesn't bother me so much as make me feel a little mystified. But what about you? I would have expected a female cop to feel reluctant to do anything like prostitution.
Not at all, Ayumi insisted cheerfully. I have no problem with that. You know, a prostitute is somebody who agrees on a price and gets her money before having sex. The first rule is, pay me before you take your pants off. She couldn't make a living if guys told her, gee, I don't have any money, after it was all over. But when there's no prior negotiation of a price, and afterward the guy gives you a little something for a taxi fare, it's just an expression of gratitude. That's different from professional prostitution. There's a clear distinction between the two.
What Ayumi had to say made a certain kind of sense. The men that Aomame and Ayumi had chosen the last time were in their late 30s or early 40s. Both had full heads of hair, but Aomame was willing to compromise on that point. They said they were with a company that dealt in real estate, but judging from their Hugo Boss suits and Missoni Uomo neckties, they were not just ordinary employees of giant conglomerates like Mitsubishi or Mitsui, whose employees were bound by finicky rules, tradition, and endless meetings, but rather they worked for a more aggressive, flexible company with a cool, foreign-sounding name, a place that looked for individual talent and richly rewarded success. One of the men carried keys to a brand new Alfa Romeo. Tokyo was short on office space, they said. The economy had recovered from the oil shocks and was showing signs of heating up again. Capital was growing ever more fluid, and soon it would be impossible to meet the need for space, no matter how many new high-rise buildings they put up.
Sounds like real estate is where the money is, Aomame said to Ayumi.
That's true, Ayumi said. If you have anything extra lying around, you ought to invest it in real estate. Huge amounts of money are just pouring into Tokyo, which is only so big. Land prices are bound to soar. Buy now and there's no way you can lose. It's like betting on horses when you know you hold the winning ticket.
Unfortunately, low-ranking public employees like me don't have anything to spare. But how about you, Aomame? Do you do any investing?
Aomame shook her head. I don't trust anything but cash.
Ayumi laughed out loud. You have the mind of a criminal.
The thing to do is keep your cash in your mattress so in a jam, you can grab it and escape out the window.
That's it, Ayumi said, snapping her fingers. Like in The Getaway, the Steve McQueen movie. A wad of bills and a shotgun. I love that kind of stuff.
More than being on the side that enforces the law?
Personally, yes, Ayumi said with a smile. I'm more drawn to outlaws. They're a whole lot more exciting than riding around in a mini patrol car and handing out parking tickets.
That's what I like about you. Do I look like an outlaw? Ayumi nodded.
How should I put it? I don't know. You just have that atmosphere about you. Though maybe not like a Faye Dunaway holding a machine gun.
I don't need a machine gun, Almama said.
About that religious commune we were talking about last time. Sakigake,
Ayumi said. The two were sharing a light meal and a bottle of Chianti at a small, late-night Italian restaurant in Iikura, a quiet neighborhood. Almama was having a salad with strips of raw tuna, while Ayumi had ordered a plate of gnocchi with basil sauce.
Uh-huh, Almama said. You got me interested, so I did a little searching on my own. And the more I looked, the fishier it began to smell. Sakigake calls itself a religion, and it even has official certification, but it's totally lacking any religious substance. Doctrine-wise, it's kind of deconstructionist or something. Just a jumble of images of religion thrown together. They've added some New Age spiritualism, fashionable academicism, a return to nature, anti-capitalism, occultism and stuff. But that's all. It has a bunch of flavors, but no substantial core. Or maybe that's what it's all about. This religion's substance is its lack of substance. In McLuhan-esque terms, the medium is the message. Some people might find that cool.
McLuhan-esque?
Hey, look, even I read a book now and then, Ayumi protested. McLuhan was ahead of his time. He was so popular for a while that people tend not to take him seriously. But what he had to say was right.
In other words, the package itself is the contents. Is that it?
Exactly. The characteristics of the package determine the nature of the contents, not the other way around.
Almame considered this for a moment and said, "The core of Sakigake as a religion is unclear. But that has nothing to do with why the people are drawn to it, you mean?"
Ayumi nodded. "I wouldn't say it's amazing how many people join Sakigake, but the numbers are by no means small. And the more people who join, the more money they put together. Obviously. So then, what is it about this religion that attracts so many people? If you ask me, it's primarily that it doesn't smell like a religion. It's very clean and intellectual, and it looks systematic. That's what attracts young professionals. It stimulates their intellectual curiosity. It provides a sense of achievement they can't get in the real world. Something tangible and personal. And these intellectual believers, like an elite officer's corps, form the powerful brains of the organization. Plus, Ayumi continued, their leader seems to have a good deal of charisma. People idolize him. His very presence, you might say, functions like a doctrinal core. It's close in origin to primitive religion. Even early Christianity was more or less like that at first. But this guy never comes out in the open. Nobody knows what he looks like, or his name, or how old he is. The religion has a governing council that supposedly runs everything, but another person heads the council and acts as the public face of the religion in official events, though I don't think he's any more than a figurehead. The one who is at the center of the system seems to be this mysterious leader person. Sounds like he wants to keep his identity hidden. Well, either he has something to hide, or he keeps his existence obscure on purpose to heighten the mysterious atmosphere around him. Or else he's tremendously ugly, Almama said. That's possible, I suppose. A grotesque creature from another world, Ayumi said with a monster's growl. But anyway, aside from the founder, this religion has too many things that stay hidden. Like the aggressive real estate dealings I mentioned on the phone the other day. Everything on the surface is there for show. The nice buildings, the handsome publicity, the intelligent-sounding theories, the former social elites who have converted, the stoic practices, the yoga and spiritual serenity, the rejection of materialism, the organic farming, the fresh air and lovely vegetarian diet. They're all like calculated photos, like ads for high-class resort condos that come as inserts in the Sunday paper. The packaging is beautiful, but I get the feeling that suspicious plans are hatching behind the scenes. Some of it might even be illegal. Now that I've been through a bunch of materials, that's the impression I get. But the police aren't making any moves now. Something may be happening undercover, but I wouldn't know about that. The Yamanashi Prefectural Police do seem to be keeping an eye on them to some extent. I kinda sensed that when I spoke to the guy in charge of the investigation. I mean, Sakigake gave birth to Akebono, the group that staged the shootout. And it's just guesswork that Akebono's Chinese-made Kalashnikovs came in through North Korea. Nobody's really gotten to the bottom of that. Sakigake is still under some suspicion, but they've got that religious juridical person label, so they have to be handled with kid gloves. The police have already investigated the premises once, and that made it more or less clear that there was no direct connection between Sakigake and the shootout. As for any moves the Public Security Intelligence Agency might be making, we just don't know. Those guys work in absolute secrecy and have never gotten along with us. How about the children who stopped coming to public school? Do you know any more about them? No, nothing. Once they stop going to school, I guess, they never come outside the walls of the compound again. We don't have any way of investigating their cases. It would be different if we had concrete evidence of child abuse. But for now, we don't have anything. Don't you get any information about that from people who have quit Sakigake? There must be a few people, at least, who become disillusioned with the religion or can't take the harsh discipline and break away. There's constant coming and going, of course. People joining, people quitting. Basically, people are free to quit any time. When they join, they make a huge donation as a permanent facility use fee and sign a contract stipulating that it is entirely non-refundable. So as long as they're willing to accept that loss, they can come out with nothing but the clothes on their backs. There's an organization of people who have quit the religion, and they accuse Sakigake of being a dangerous antisocial cult engaged in fraudulent activity. They filed a suit and put out a little newsletter, but they're such a small voice they have virtually zero impact on public opinion. The religion has a phalanx of top lawyers, and they've put together a watertight defense. One lawsuit can't budge them. Haven't the ex-members made any statements about leader or the children inside? I don't know, Ayumi said. I've never read their newsletter. As far as I've been able to check, though, all the dissidents are from the lowest ranks of the group, just small fry. Sakigake makes a big deal about how they reject all worldly values, but part of the organization is completely hierarchical, sharply divided between the leadership and the rest of them. You can't become a member of the leadership without an advanced degree or specialized professional qualifications. Only elite believers in the leadership group ever get to see or receive direct instruction from leader or make contact with key figures of the organization. All the others just make their required donations and spend one sterile day after another performing their religious austerities in the fresh air, devoting themselves to farming, or spending hours in the meditation rooms. They're like a flock of sheep, led out to pasture under the watchful eye of the shepherd and his dog, and brought back to their shed at night, one peaceful day after the next. They look forward to the day when their position rises high enough in the organization for them to come into the presence of Big Brother. But that day never comes. That's why ordinary believers know almost nothing about the inner workings of the organization. Even if they quit Sakigake They don't have any important information they can offer the outside world. They've never even seen Leader's face.
Aren't there any members of the elite who have quit?
Not one, as far as I can tell.
Does that mean you're not allowed to leave once you've learned the secrets?
There might be some pretty dramatic developments if it came to that,
Ayumi said with a short sigh. Then she said to Aomame,
So tell me, about that raping of little girls you mentioned. How definite is that?
Pretty definite, but there's still no proof.
It's being done systematically inside the commune?
That's not entirely clear either. We do have one actual victim, though. I've met the girl. They did terrible things to her.
By rape, do you mean actual penetration?
Yes, there's no question about that.
Ayumi twisted her lips at an angle, thinking. I've got it. Let me dig into this a little more in my own way.
Don't get in over your head now.
Don't worry, Ayumi said. I may not look it, but I'm very cautious.
They finished their meal, and the waiter cleared the table. They declined to order dessert, and instead continued drinking wine.
Ayumi said, Remember how you told me that no men had fooled around with you when you were a little girl?
Aomame glanced at Ayumi, registering the look on her face, and nodded. My family was very religious. There was never any talk of sex, and it was the same with all the other families we knew. Sex was a forbidden topic.
Well, okay, but being religious has nothing to do with the strength or weakness of a person's sex drive. Everybody knows the clergy is full of sex freaks. In fact, we arrest a lot of people connected with religion and with education for stuff like prostitution and groping women on commuter trains.
Maybe so, but at least in our circles, there was no hint of that kind of thing. Nobody who did anything they shouldn't.
Well, good for you, Ayumi said. I'm glad to hear it.
It was different for you? Instead of responding immediately, Ayumi gave a little shrug. Then she said,
To tell you the truth, they messed around with me a lot when I was a girl.
Who were they?
My brother and my uncle.
Aomame grimaced slightly. Your brother and uncle?
That's right. They're both policemen now. Not too long ago, my uncle even received official commendation as an outstanding officer. 30 years of continuous service, major contributions to public safety and the district, and to improvement of the environment. He was featured in the paper once for saving a stupid dog and her pup that wandered into a rail crossing.
What do they do to you?
Touch me down there. Maybe give them blowjobs.
The wrinkles of Aomame's grimace deepened.
Your brother and uncle?
Separately, of course. I think I was 10 and my brother maybe 15. My uncle did it before that, 2 or 3 times, when he stayed over with us.
Did you tell anybody?
Ayumi responded with a few slow shakes of the head.
I didn't say a word. They warned me not to, threatened that they'd get me if I said anything. And even if they hadn't, I was afraid if I told, they'd blame me for it and punish me. I was too scared to tell anybody.
Not even your mother?
Especially my mother, Ayumi said. My brother had always been her favorite, and she was always telling me how disappointed she was in me. I was sloppy, I was fat. I wasn't pretty enough, my grades in school were nothing special. She wanted a different kind of daughter. A slim, cute little doll to send to ballet lessons. It was like asking for the impossible.
So you didn't want to disappoint her even more?
Right. I was sure if I told her what my brother was doing, she'd hate me even more. She'd say it was my fault instead of blaming him.
Aomame used her fingers to smooth out the wrinkles in her face. My mother refused to talk to me after I announced that I was abandoning the faith at the age of 10. She'd handed me notes when it was absolutely necessary to communicate something, but she would never speak. I ceased to be her daughter. I was just the one who abandoned the faith. I moved out after that.
But there was no penetration, Almama asked Ayumi.
No penetration, Ayumi said. As bad as they were, they couldn't do anything that painful to me. Not even they would demand that much.
Do you still see this brother and uncle of yours?
Hardly ever after I took a job and left the house. But we are relatives after all, and we're in the same profession. Sometimes I can't avoid seeing them. And when I do, I'm all smiles. I don't do anything to rock the boat. I bet they don't even remember that something like that ever happened.
Don't remember?
Sure, they can forget about it, Ayumi said. I never can.
Of course not, Almama said.
It's like some historic massacre.
Massacre?
The ones who did it can always rationalize their actions and even forget what they did. They can turn away from things they don't want to see. But the surviving victims can never forget. They can't turn away. Their memories are passed on from parent to child. That's what the world is, after all. An endless battle of contrasting memories.
True, Almama said, scowling slightly.
An endless battle of contrasting memories?
To tell you the truth, Ayumi said, I kind of thought that you must have had the same kind of experience as me.
Why did you think that?
I don't know. I can't really explain it, I just sort of figured. Maybe I thought that having wild one-night stands with strange men was a result of something like that. And in your case, I thought I detected some kind of anger, too. Anyhow, you just don't seem like someone who can do the ordinary thing. You know, like everybody else does? Find a regular boyfriend, go out on a date, have a meal, and have sex in the usual way with just the one person. It's more or less the same with me.
You're saying that you couldn't follow the normal pattern because something messed around with you when you were little?
That's how I felt,
Ayumi said. She gave a little shrug.
To tell you the truth, I'm afraid of men. Or rather, I'm afraid of getting deeply involved with one particular man, of completely taking on another person. The very thought of it makes me cringe. But being alone can be hard sometimes. I want a man to hold me, to put his thing inside me. I want it so bad I can't stand it sometimes. Not knowing the man at all makes it easier. A lot easier.
Because you're afraid of men?
I think that's a large part of it.
I don't think I have any fear of men, Almama said.
Is there anything you are afraid of?
Of course there is, Almama said. The thing I'm most afraid of is me. Of not knowing what I'm going to do. Of not knowing what I'm doing right now.
What are you doing right now?
Almama stared at the wine glass in her hand for a time.
I wish I knew.
She looked up.
But I don't. I can't even be sure what world I'm in now, what year I'm in. It's 1984. We're in Tokyo, in Japan. I wish I could declare that with such certainty.
You're strange, Ayumi said with a smile.
They're just self-evident truths. Declaring and certainty are beside the point.
I can't explain it very well, but I can't say they're self-evident truths to me.
You can't?
Ayumi said, as if deeply impressed.
I'm not quite sure what you're talking about, but I will say this. Whatever time and place this might be, you do have one person you love deeply, and that's something I can only envy. I don't have anybody like that.
Almama set her wine glass down on the table and dabbed at her mouth with her napkin. Then she said, "You may be right. Whatever time and place this might be, totally unrelated to that. I want to see him. I want to see him so badly I could die. That's the one thing that seems certain. It's the only thing I can say with confidence. Want me to have a look at the police materials? If you give me the basic information, we might be able to find out where he is and what he's doing."
Almame shook her head. "Please don't look for him. I think I told you before, I'll run into him sometime, somewhere, strictly by chance. I'll just keep patiently waiting for that time to come."
"Like a big romantic TV series," Ayumi said, impressed. "I love stuff like that. I get chills just thinking about it."
"It's tough on the one who's actually doing it, though."
"I know what you mean,"
Ayumi said, lightly pressing her fingers against her temples.
"But still, even though you're that much in love with him, you feel like sleeping with strange men every once in a while."
Almame clicked her fingernails against the rim of the thin wine glass. "I need to do it, to keep myself in balance as a flesh and blood human being."
"And it doesn't destroy the love you have inside you,"
Almame said. "It's like the Tibetan wheel of the passions. As the wheel turns, the values and feelings on the outer rim rise and fall, shining or sinking into darkness. But true love stays fastened to the axle and doesn't move."
"Marvelous," Ayumi said. "The Tibetan wheel of passions, huh?"
And she drank down the wine remaining in her glass. 2 days later, a little after 8 o'clock at night, a call came from Tamaru. As always, he skipped the preliminary greetings and went straight to business.
"Are you free tomorrow afternoon?"
"I don't have a thing in the afternoon. I can come over whenever you need me."
"How about 4:30?
Almame said that would be fine.
"Good," Tamaru said.
She could hear his ballpoint pen scratching the time into his calendar. He was pressing down hard.
"How is Tsubasa doing?"
Almame asked.
"She's doing well, I think. Madame is going there every day to look after her. The girl seems to be growing fond of her."
"That's good news."
"Yes, it is good news. But something else happened that is not so good."
"Something not so good?" Almame knew that when Tamaru said something was not so good, it had to be terrible.
"The dog died," Tamaru said.
"The dog? You mean Bun?"
"Yes, the funny German shepherd that likes spinach. She died last night."
Almame was shocked to hear this. The dog was maybe 5 or 6 years old, not an age for dying. She was perfectly healthy the last time I saw her.
"She didn't die from illness," Tamaru said, his voice flat. "I found her this morning in pieces."
"In pieces?"
"As if she had exploded. Her guts were splattered all over the place. It was pretty intense. I had to go around picking up chunks of flesh with paper towels. The force of the blast turned her body inside out. It was as if somebody had set off a small but powerful bomb inside her stomach."
"The poor dog."
"Oh well, there's nothing to be done about the dog," Tamaru said. "She's dead and won't be coming back. I can find another guard dog to take her place. What worries me, though, is what happened. It wasn't something that any ordinary person could do. Setting off a bomb inside a dog like that. For one thing, that dog barked like crazy whenever a stranger approached. This was not an easy thing to carry off."
"That's for sure," Almame said in a dry tone of voice.
"The women in the safe house are scared to death. The one in charge of feeding the dog found her like that this morning. First, she puked her guts out, and then she called me. I asked if anything suspicious happened during the night. Not a thing, she said. Nobody heard an explosion.
If there had been such a big sound, everybody would have woken up for sure. These women live in fear even in the best of times. It must have been a soundless explosion, and nobody heard the dog bark. It was an especially quiet night, but when morning came, there was a dog inside out. Fresh organs had been blown all over, and the neighborhood crows were having a great time. For me, though, it was nothing but worries.
Something weird is happening.
That's for sure, Tamaru said. Something weird is happening. And if what I'm feeling is right, this is just the beginning of something.
Did you call the police?
Hell no, Tamaru said with a contemptuous little snort. The police are useless. Looking in the wrong place for the wrong thing, they just complicate matters.
What does Madame say?
Nothing. She just nodded when I gave her my report, Tamaru said. All security measures are my responsibility. From beginning to end, it's my job.
A short silence followed. A heavy silence having to do with responsibility. Tomorrow at 4:30, Almama said.
Tomorrow at 4:30, Tamaru repeated, and quietly hung up.
Chapter 24. Tengo. What's the point of its being a world that isn't here? It rained all Thursday morning, not a heavy downpour, but persistent rain. There had been no let-up since the previous afternoon. Whenever it seemed about to stop, it would start pouring again. June was half gone without a sign the rainy season would ever end. The sky remained dark, as if covered with a lid, and the world wore a heavy dampness. Just before noon, Tengo put on a raincoat and hat and was headed out to the local market when he noticed a brown padded envelope in his mailbox. It bore no postmark, stamps, or address, and no return address either. His name had been written with a ballpoint pen in the middle of the front in small, stiff characters that might have been scratched into dry clay with a nail. Fukaeri's writing, without question. He tore it open to find a single bare 60-minute TDK audio tape cassette. No letter or memo accompanied it. It was not in a plastic case, and the cassette bore no label. After a moment of uncertainty, Tengo decided to forget about shopping and listen to the tape. Back in his apartment, he held the cassette in the air and gave it several shakes. For all the mystery surrounding its arrival, it was obviously just an ordinary mass-produced object. There was nothing suggesting it would explode after he played it. Taking off his raincoat, he set a radio cassette player on the kitchen table. He removed the cassette from the padded envelope and inserted it into the player, next to which he placed memo paper and a ballpoint pen in case he wanted to take notes. After looking around to make certain there was no one else present, he pressed the play button. There was no sound at first. This lasted for some time. Just as he was beginning to suspect that it was nothing but a blank tape, there was some sudden bumping sounds, like the moving of a chair. Then a light clearing of the throat, it seemed. Then, without warning, Fukaeri began to speak. "Tengo," she said, as if in a sound test. As far as he could recall, this was probably the first time she had actually called him by name. She cleared her throat again. She seemed tense. "I should write you a letter, but I'm bad at that, so I'll record a tape. It's easier for me to talk this way than on the phone. Somebody might be listening on the phone. Wait, I need water." Tengo heard what he thought were the sounds of Fukaeri picking up a glass, taking a drink, and setting the glass back down on a table. Recorded on tape, her uniquely unaccented manner of speech, without question marks or other punctuation, sounded even stranger than in conversation. It was almost unreal. On tape, however, as opposed to conversation, she was able to speak several sentences in a row. "I hear you don't know where I am. You might be worried. But you don't have to be. This is not a dangerous place. I wanted to tell you that. I really shouldn't do this, but I felt like I ought to." 10 seconds of silence. "They told me not to tell anyone. That I'm here. The professor filed a search request with the police to look for me. But they're not doing anything. Kids run away all the time, so I will just stay still here a while. 15 seconds of silence. This place is far away. No one will find me if I don't go out walking. Very far away. Azami will bring this tape to you. Better not send it in the mail. Gotta be careful. Wait, I'll make sure it's recording. A click. An empty interval. Another click. Good, it's recording. Children shouting in the distance. Faint sounds of music. These were probably coming through an open window. There might have been a kindergarten nearby. Thanks for putting me up that time. I needed you to do that. I also needed to get to know you. Thanks for reading the book to me. I felt close to the Gilyaks. Why do the Gilyaks walk through the forest swamps and not on the wide roads? Tengo secretly added a question mark at the end. Even if the roads are convenient, it's easier for the Gilyaks to keep away from the roads and walk through the forest. To walk on the roads, they would have to completely remake the way they walk. If they remade the way they walk, they would have to remake other things. I couldn't live like the Gilyaks. I would hate for men to hit me all the time. I would hate to live with a lot of maggots around. So dirty. But I don't like to walk on wide roads either. I need more water. Fukaeri took another drink of water. After a short silence, her glass came back to the table with a clunk. Then there was an interval while she wiped her lips with her fingertips. Didn't this girl realize that tape recorders have pause buttons? I think it might be trouble for you that I went away, but I don't want to be a novelist and I don't plan to write any more. I asked Azami to look up stuff about the Gilyaks for me. She went to the library. The Gilyaks live in Sakhalin and are like the Ainu and American Indians. They don't have writing. They don't leave records. I'm the same. Once it gets written down, the story is not mine anymore. You did a good job of writing my story. I don't think anybody else could do that. But it's not my story anymore. But don't worry. It's not your fault. I'm just walking in a place away from the road. Here, Fukaeri inserted another pause. Tengo imagined her trudging along silently, alone, off to the side, away from a road. The professor has big power and deep wisdom, but the little people have just as deep wisdom and big power as he does. Better be careful in the forest. Important things are in the forest, and the little people are in the forest too. To make sure the little people don't harm you, you have to find something the little people don't have. If you do that, you can get through the forest safely. Having managed to say all this in one go, Fukaeri paused to take a deep breath. She did this without averting her face from the microphone, thereby recording what sounded like a huge gust of wind blowing between buildings. When that quieted down, there came the deep, foghorn-like sound of a large truck honking in the distance. Two short blasts. Apparently Fukaeri was in a place not far from a major highway. Clearing of throat. I'm getting hoarse. Thanks for worrying about me. Thanks for liking my chest shape and putting me up in your apartment and lending me your pajamas. We probably can't see each other for a while. The little people may be mad that they were put into writing. But don't worry. I'm used to the forest. Bye. There was a click, and the recording ended. Tengo stopped the tape and rewound to the beginning. Listening to the rain dripping from the eaves, he took several deep breaths and twirled the plastic ballpoint pen in his fingers. Then he set the pen down. He had not taken a single note. He had merely listened in fascination to Fukaeri's normally peculiar narrative style. Without resorting to note-taking, he had grasped the three main points of her message. One, she had not been abducted, but was merely in temporary hiding. There was no need to worry about her. Two, she had no intention of publishing any more books. Her story was meant for oral transmission, not print. Three, the little people possessed no less wisdom and power than Professor Ebisuno. Tengo should be careful. These were the points she hoped to convey. She also spoke of the Gilyaks, the people who had to stay off broad roads when they walked. Tengo went to the kitchen and made himself some coffee. While drinking his coffee, he stared aimlessly at the cassette tape. Then he listened to it again from the beginning. This time, just to make sure, he occasionally pushed the pause button and took brief notes. Then he let his eyes make their way through the notes. This led to no new discoveries. Had Fukaeri made her own simple notes at first and followed them as she spoke into the recorder? Tengo could not believe she had done that. She wasn't the type to do such a thing. She had undoubtedly spoken her thoughts into the mic as they came to her in real time, without even pushing the pause button. What kind of place could she be in? The recorded background noises provided Tengo with few hints. The distant sound of a door slamming, children's shouts apparently coming in through an open window. A kindergarten? A truck horn. She was obviously not deep in the woods, but somewhere in a city. The time of the recording was probably late morning or early afternoon. The sound of the door might suggest that she was not alone. One thing was clear. Fukaeri had gone into hiding on her own initiative. No one had forced her to make the tape. That much was obvious from the sound of her voice and the way she spoke. There was some perceptible nervousness at the beginning, but otherwise it sounded as if she had freely spoken her own thoughts into the microphone. The professor has big power and deep wisdom, but the little people have just as deep wisdom and big power as he does. Better be careful in the forest. Important things are in the forest, and the little people are in the forest too. To make sure the little people don't harm you, you have to find something the little people don't have. If you do that, you can get through the forest safely. Tengo played that part back one more time. Fukaeri narrated this section somewhat more rapidly than the others. The intervals between sentences were a touch shorter. The little people were beings who possessed the potential for harming both Tengo and Professor Ebisuno, but he could not discern in Fukaeri's tone of voice any suggestion that she had written them off as evil. Judging from the way she spoke of them, they seemed like neutral beings who could go either way. Tengo had misgivings about another passage. The little people may be mad that they were put into writing. If the little people were, in fact, angry, it stood to reason that Tengo himself would be one of the objects of their anger. He was, after all, one of those most responsible for having publicized their existence in print. Even if he were to beg their forgiveness on the grounds that he had done so without malice, they were not likely to listen to him. What kind of harm did the little people inflict on others? Tengo could hardly be expected to know the answer. He rewound the tape again, returned it to the envelope, and stuffed it in a drawer. Putting his raincoat and hat on again, he set out for the market once more in the pouring rain. Komatsu telephoned after 9 o'clock that night. Once again, Tengo knew it was Komatsu before he lifted the receiver. He was in bed, reading. He let the phone ring 3 times, eased himself out of bed, and sat at the kitchen table to answer the call. "Hey, Tengo," Komatsu said. "Having a drink?" "No, I'm sober." "You may want a drink after this call," Komatsu said. "Must be about something enjoyable." "I wonder. I don't think it's all that enjoyable. It might have a certain amount of paradoxical humor about it, though."
"Like a Chekhov short story."
"Exactly," Komatsu said. "Like a Chekhov short story. Well said. Your expressions are always concise and to the point, Tengo." Tengo remained silent. Komatsu went on.
"Things have taken a somewhat problematic turn. The police have responded to Professor Ebisuno's search request by formally initiating a search for Fukaeri. I don't think they'll go so far as to actually mount a full-scale search, though, especially since there's been no ransom demand or anything. They'll probably just go through the motions so it won't be too embarrassing for them if something really does come up. Otherwise, it'll look as if they stood by with their arms folded.
The media are not going to let it go so easily, though. I've already gotten several inquiries from the papers. I pretended to know nothing, of course. I mean, there's nothing to say at this point. By now, they've probably uncovered the relationship between Fukaeri and Professor Ebisuno, as well as her parents' background as revolutionaries. Lots of facts like that are going to start coming out.
The problem is with the weekly magazines. Their freelancers, or journalists, or whatever you call them, will start circling like sharks smelling blood. They're all good at what they do, and once they latch on, they don't let go. Their livelihood depends.